This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Martin Lichmetz. He's an Austrian journalist, and we're going to be discussing his new book. It's a German language book, Ethnopluralismus, but it's about the political concept of ethnopluralism. Martin, it's great speaking with you.
Hello.
Martin, can you give our audience some background information about yourself?
Well, right, I was born, I live in Vienna. I am a journalist, writer and translator. I have been associated with the German New Right and also with the identitarian movement in Austria and Germany. And by now I have written several books. This is probably my, I don't know, sixth or seventh. I haven't really counted. I have also done a few other things, like I did a German translation of the famous novel Camp of the Saints by Jean Raspail in German, and it also became a minor bestseller in 2015 when we had the refugee crisis. So, well, I guess these are the most important things to say about me.
The book is about ethno-pluralism, and the concept, it's generally associated, as far as the origins go, with Alain de Benoist and the French New Right. Can you give a sort of, like, to start things off, like a brief introduction to the concept and why you decided to write a book about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can make the introduction brief, because my book was all about sorting out what this concept actually means. It has been used as a catchword, but initially not on the New Right or so-called New Right when I joined it, which was back in about 2005 in Germany. I don't recall that anybody would really use that word or that concept. And it became a new, became fashionable, so to speak, in New Right circles again with the identitarian movement, where it was picked up by, for example, Martin Sellner and others, and also heavily influenced by these French New Right writers. But it was there all the time in the writings of the so-called experts on the far right. There are plenty of them in Germany, and they're all funded by the state, and they all write these framings and interpretations of what the New Right is supposedly about. And if you are yourself, consider yourself to be a New Right person, you will not really find really what you actually think when you read those books. But these are the ones that dominate the discourse and that dominate Wikipedia pages and dominate information sites funded by the German state. So there's the problem of the right that we need to frame our own concepts, but at the same time somebody else is always doing it for us. And I thought that this concept of ethnopluralism was mentioned all the time in these books about the far right, and said, "Ooh, it is a central concept," and the interpretation was simply this. The simplest form would be to say, well, we think that every people has a right for self-determination, has a right for its own nation or country, and this does mean that we do respect other people or also other races. We do not judge them, but we just don't want them in our country. We want to have clear separation between yours and our country, and so everybody can live according to his own values and his own traditions and all that. This is the simplest form of it. And there's a, I mean, actually, I'm starting my book with a joke, which is from Asterix. You know, this is the French comic book about the Gauls. Yeah, and there's an episode with Methuselix. That's the way he's called in German. He's the old guy who is married to this stunning young blonde. And there's one episode where they have some people from the big city moving into the little village, and the old guy says, "I don't worry about strangers as long as they stay where they belong." And another line he has in that comic book is when he says, "I have nothing against strangers. I like strangers, but these people, these strangers, are not from here." So this is a sort of caricature of this notion. And in my research about the leftist writing on ethnopluralism, I also found, for example, a quote by a woman. She was a sympathizer of the Freedom Party in Austria, and she was interviewed back in the 1990s, and she said, "I do appreciate foreign cultures, I just don't want to have them close to me."
I think it's important to kind of clarify, because there's sort of some confusion about the definition, like, are there specific policies? Because there's the idea of having nations that are specific to one group of people, and to what degree is that basically similar to ethno-pluralism, but just like rebranded for better optics?
Yes, I mean, if people look up a concept on the internet, they Google it and they usually find Wikipedia. So I find the German Wikipedia site on ethno-pluralism, and it's a complete mess. I mean, it has been done over the last 15 years, and there were rewritings after rewritings, and most were just copying from left-wing studies or left-wing books about the far right, and there's a huge pile of nonsense rising up. So you go there, and then you find the thing that ethno-pluralism is a notion that replaces culture for race. So instead of talking about race, for example, you talk about culture. You do not say anymore that it's not racist, they do not get along with each other, but it's cultures. And then you make an argument for example, against immigration. And this is being summed up with the notion of racism without races. This was coined by a French Marxist, Balibar, Etienne Balibar. He coined this notion in the 1980s, 1985 or so. So you have this concept of racism without races, which is, quite fuzzy. But the main idea is ethno-pluralism is just an optics makeup for something, darker, which is probably some sort of, Nazi ideology or old school racism or so. This is the narrative, the story they go along. And so you see, I wanted to, of course, dismantle this narrative, but I also wanted to find out, also for myself, what ideas are actually connected with that notion. And to my surprise, when I was reading Alain de Benoist, and he had a huge influence on me, I noticed that he would never use this word, ethno-pluralism, never at all.
So when you go to Wikipedia, you're saying it's not accurate that Alain de Benoist coined the phrase ethno-pluralism?
No, it's not true at all. And I also asked him about it, and he says, no, this word was never used in Nouvelle Droite writing. So there's also an alternative French word called ethno-differentialisme, ethno-differentialism. And they also did not use it, or at least they did not use it systematically. But if you go into what Benoist said in the 1970s, and he has been very consistent until today, it is actually this idea that some call ethno-pluralism. But the guy who really coined the word in 1973 was a German New Right guy. His name was Henning Eichberg. And he's a very interesting figure, and also the context in which he coined this phrase is very interesting. And it led me to this conviction, or this thesis, if you like, that ethno-pluralism has never been a single dogmatic concept, but there are several concepts that can be, you know, it's like a family of ideas. And there are several versions of it, several takes on this, and it was never a dogmatic idea. So, for example, if you're interested in the New Right and you say, where can I look this up, what this actually is, and so then there is not a single book. Now it is, it's mine.
Oh, yeah.
before that, it did not exist. You just had to, and the writings of Henning Eichberg, they were not easy to find. And I could talk a bit about him and his notion, which could clarify how this concept actually started to, if you like, you know. I can talk a bit about him. I think it could be quite clarifying what we are talking about.
Because I've heard different versions of the same, under the same terminology, so one version is just kind of rebranding the idea of basing nations on a particular ethnicity, which does have bad optics. Then the other definition I've heard of ethno-pluralism is basically that it's just where people share the same nation and the same state, but where each group has freedom of association and is able to create their own independent institution. So I've heard many different definitions. I want to get to those themes some more, but if you want to kind of explain the concepts, original concepts from Henning Eichberg.
I guess I'll just start again talking about Henning Eichberg. He's the guy who phrased the word ethno-pluralism, but the concept is much older, and I would date it back to the 18th century to Johann Gottfried Herder, who was a romantic philosopher. So we can talk about him as well. But first I want to go to Henning Eichberg and his political way, I think, is quite telling about how this notion or this concept came about and what it is about. So Eichberg, he was born in 1943 in Silesia, which is now Poland. And his family was ethnically cleansed in 1945. So like many Germans from the East. And the first years of his life he spent in the Eastern Zone, and then the family crossed over into the Western Zone. So this is a thing that he had all his life, this question of his German national identity, but it was not connected to a particular state. So you see, he would see himself as an expellee from the East in Western Germany, and he did never feel at home there. And when he was a young man, he was attracted by old school German nationalist circles, like say old right circles, and this is where he started writing his first articles, and he had his first context. And now, one of the major publications of that old right, or maybe already they were already facing towards something new, was a magazine that was called Nation Europe, and it took its name from Oswald Mosley. He had this concept of European nation, and it was mostly edited by people who were associated with the international Waffen-SS, you see, in Second World War. So this was, so to speak, a fascist background, so I'm not saying it in a derogative way, but in a factual way. But there was a pan-European idea behind it. So the idea that Europa had fought two wars in this century, both were incited by nationalism, and now Europe has to find a new way, a new unity. Germany and France, for example, have overcome the old enmities, and it's important to have a new European idea, because there are two dangers facing Europe, and one is the threat from communism, from the Soviet Union, and the other is from American hegemony, you know, imperialism, American cultural influence or political influence. And of course, there were other issues. So in the 1960s, there was the whole process of decolonization starting, and you could see the rising of the so-called third world. So there was a lot of going on in the world. And of course, this idea, you know, would make sense that Europe needs to unite. And now, so Eichberg, he would in the mid of the 1960s, he would encounter these people from the French new, what was to become the French New Right. And now this had a similar way like his. First, he started in the old French Right, like they were all hooting for, you know, Algérie Française, that Algeria has to stay with France. And they also had sort of fascist background or sympathies. And they were gradually moving away from this in the mid-60s towards new positions. And they also had a very useful revolutionary spirit. And they also were not worried about boxing of left and right. So many of them had ideas that tended much more to the left, sort of socialist ideas or so. And of course, this was the time of the student revolt in 1968 in France, when there were very different groups who at times would form coalitions, and so a lot of was going on. And these young nationalists in France and Germany, they were inspired by this, and they thought there needs to be a new way to rebrand nationalism, so to speak. Yeah, and for Eichberg, it was now, his central problem was that he was living in a divided country, which was robbed of its identity. So on one side you have Americans, the other side you have Russians or Soviets, and both are indoctrinating the Germans with their view of history and their ideology. But where is Germany now? Where is the German identity now? This was a lifelong question. And at one point, he felt that actually all these third world countries that are liberating themselves from colonial rule and from French or from British or other rule, don't they have something in common with Germany? His idea was that Germany actually was a colonized state, colonized and divided by on one side Americans, other side Russians, and that it was prerogative to frame nationalism as a sort of emancipatory movement that would liberate itself from these foreign dominations, but also from the ideologies behind it. And the ideologies would be either communism, Marxism, or liberalism, American liberalism, or capitalism, if you like. And what do these have in common? And his answer would be, well, these are universalist ideologies. They say this idea I have, communism or capitalism, is supposed to work for everybody. It's supposed to unite the world, and and both ideologies are based on the idea that all men are created equal. And he saw this idea that probably what would be against this, what is the opposite of universalism, and this would be particularism or nationalism, specifically in this frame he was thinking of it, like nationalism is also a sort of solidarity, there has to be a social conscience to it, and a rejection of universalism. And so he started to see a bigger picture, like he would say, maybe all these nations or people that are fighting against either communist or American capitalist rule have something in common. They may be in Europe, they may be in the third world, and even within bigger nations, there are smaller nations or ethnic groups that suffer the same. For example, France is one thing that France used to be a very centralized state, and the French nation was in a way forced upon several ethnic groups like the Basques or the Corsicans or the Bretons and so groups that used to have also movements of autonomy. Let's jump to 1973, and Eichberg, he's a sociology student, and he's working in an academic framework. And he publishes this one article which criticizes European or Western universalism in a context of international development for third world countries. So he says there's this idea of progress that you force upon African countries, for example, an idea where they should advance to, an aim what they should become. They say, "Oh, these nations are backward and they have to go forward to our industrialized modern idea of progress." So you have to have an idea of progress, and you have to lift them up, so to speak. You have to lift them up out of poverty and out of, I don't know, superstition or dated concepts and so on. It's all well meant. It's all well meant. You want to help them. You know, you don't want to colonize them anymore. You want to help them. And now Eichberg says, and he wasn't, of course, the only one. There was also many on the left who had this idea. He says, what actually is happening here is that you are imposing a Western concept to other people, which it might destroy with this imposition. This imposition might not work for them. It might actually be very, very fatal if you want to make them be like us. Huh? So, and this is when the word ethnopluralism came in. It was its opposite in this article was Eurocentrism. He called it Eurocentrism. So this Eurocentric idea, our European Western ideas or values or concepts of progress apply to everyone, apply to all people. And he said, but you have to realize that ethnopluralism is a fact. So firstly, it's a fact. He says, if you look at the world is full of different sorts of peoples and cultures. And they have different values and they have different ways of living, and they may even have different, you know, ways of experiencing time and space and of aesthetics and all that. This is foremost, it's a fact. Huh? But the second step is to say it should also be like this. You know, it's better like this. The idea to make everything homogenic, to create a one world where everybody has the same values, the same political system, the same economic system is horrible. And this is what universalist ideologies aim to do. Capitalism does it, communism does it, and this is what uproots and destroys people. So this is where this concept, also the phrasing, started. And so I think this is a very significant context here.
I think when a lot of people hear the term ethnopluralism, they're thinking about different groups sharing the same nation. It's been referred to as a rightist kind of form of multiculturalism. So what we have now, like the kind of current woke culture, what does explicitly have like these double standards, but it could ironically lead to liberalism being dismantled and replaced by some kind of a neo-tribalism, and you do have these examples of wokeness becoming, like, in some cases more like almost like segregationists, like the minority groups being given their own spaces in university, and then there's this idea of replacing woke multiculturalism and having more inclusive version, multiculturalism where all groups, including, say, white people, can take part, a kind of like a multipolar tribalism, while each group has their own institutions while maintaining loyalty to the same state. And I mean, that obviously could be a difficult task to maintain. So you mentioned something about the Canadian political figures, Charles Taylor and Greg Kimlicka. Yeah, multiculturalism. So say like the English and the French are as much part of it in Canada. Can you comment on that particular model? And is that different than the type of ethnopluralism you're describing in your book?
Yeah, well, the problem about the idea that you have different ethnic groups within a common political entity like a nation state is where they are located, to say it simply. Where do they live? What is the space they inhabit in? And the thing is that nation states, the way we know it, homogeneous nation states, are a quite new invention in history. So this idea came up in the 19th century. And
are you talking about the Westphalian concept of a nation state that broke away from empires like the Habsburgs?
But I'm going much further in the, you know, 19th century was the time when the national movements really rose up, and they were aimed at against imperial rule, for example, Habsburgs or Russians or Osman Empire and all that. And after World War One, you have the breakup of these empires in several nation states, and you have the. I'm not yet at Canada. You know, I'm just making a bit of a further look back into history. And you have the idea proposed by Woodrow Wilson of the self-determination of people, of nations, which was on the surface a nice idea, but the main idea was, of course, to break up these empires, which were the enemies in the war. And the problem was that the borders cannot be exactly drawn, because where the populations live and where the you cannot draw exact borders according to the national population. So this is what created states that were insufficient nation states after World War One, and sometimes there were blatant mistakes being made or disregards of ethnic interests, and all this, you know, fueled World War Two, so to speak. So here's a problem that the homogenic nation state is a quite rare thing, and you will always have minorities in that state, even if a certain people or nation will dominate.
There are people who advocate that position of carving out nations that are 100% like homogenous. I just don't see that model as practical.
No, it's not only practical, but it's also, I mean, if you apply it in reality, it leads to ethnic cleansing, bloodshed. It's very, very gruesome. I mean, it sort of works. It was done, I mentioned that Henning Eichberg, he was from the German East. It did work, sort of, like when after World War II, about, 12 million Germans were removed from the East, about 3 million perished, many of them. It's a post-war war crime, which few people know about. But after that, you had a quite homogenic Poland or Czechoslovakia or Czechia, and from that point on, there was peace. It worked, sort of, you know. Similar, you hear sometimes Israeli historians like this guy Benny Morris. He actually says that problem of 1984 and the years after that is that the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians was not enough, you know, that there were still too many that remained inside the borders of Israel. And this is a gruesome thing to say, but in a way he's right. So it does work. It also works in Yugoslavia, but there's a heavy price to be paid, and I'm not sure if this price is worth it. But this is another discussion. I mean, I can go to Canada now here. So the Canadian story is interesting. And
so this, you're talking about the Canadian vision of multiculturalism. So
yeah,
I mean, today Canada is very woke, but you're talking about the original version.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the wokeness was already included in the original version. It's, in a way, the course of things that led up to it. So Ricardo Duchesne, who wrote Uniqueness of Western Civilization, he was my main source for this. He wrote a lot about it, also critique of Kim Lika and Charles Taylor. And it's interesting how this started. So first, in the 1960s, you had basically a binational nation, like French and Anglo-Canadians. And you had also natives, you know, Indians. So these were three most important groups. They had very few blacks because they did not have so much slaves. The main conflict was between the Anglo and the French group, and there were great tensions at that time. So the French group demanded more autonomy. There was even terrorist attacks and things like this. So they needed to work out a solution for this. But in the course of working out the solution, and it was done under Pierre Trudeau, who was the father of the main, you know, king of wokeness today, Justin Trudeau, they developed the idea that possibly Canada could be even more. You could turn Canada into maybe something like the first really universal nation, multinational nation that might work much better than America, you know, USA, which had also this idea of becoming a universal nation by applying a melting pot. But the Canadian model would be different. You would not have a melting pot, but you would have more like what Horace Kallen called the salad bowl. So you have groups that maintain their identity, maintain a certain autonomy, whether it be the French or the Indians, but they are within the framework of that state. And the next step is, I would say, the next important step of Canada was that they would do away with an immigration system that was based on race. I mean, more or less, like they had in US until 1960s, or Australia until 1970s, I think, which would prefer like white people, to make it easier. But then this race issue would be done away with, and they would apply more meritocratic measurement, like to say, okay, we take in people, but they need to speak the language, they need to be educated, and so on. So this would be the model, and they can come from wherever, you know, they can come from any country. You see, Asians took a lot of advantage of this, so they basically colonized Vancouver and all that. So Canada more and more grew into this super, super diverse nation at the expense of the Anglos, I would say. And now comes in Charles Taylor, who is sort of the official state philosopher of the Canadian model. And the interesting thing is that he does refer, just like Henning Eichberg did, to Johann Gottfried Herder, the romantic philosopher, German philosopher from the 18th century. We can talk about Herder maybe later, but the idea is that he says, no, it's wrong to force ethnic groups into assimilation. It hurts their self-respect, their identity. They have just to follow certain laws. But he also would get a step further and say, but in order to maintain their identity, they should be allowed to have certain kinds of different laws. You know, like in an Indian reservation, they would have some extra laws, you see. So the idea is that every group has to provide for a group to maintain their identity, but this would also mean special rights for these groups.
So those are the special rights, basically means the double standards. So yeah, that's like the foundation of woke ideology as it is. Like there's all these different political solutions, and you kind of have to rank them as like what are the most practical. And I think a kind of rightist version of multiculturalism where all groups are allowed to take part. We'd have to kind of discard like the kind of double standard. I think it would like fundamentally change the identity of America, but I think that's going to be inevitable. And you do see this with like American conservatism, the concept of MAGA taking back America. I mean, it could have a demographic overtone, as a lot of woke types will say it's a dog whistle, but there's also kind of Americanism as an ideology, and just kind of an overall decline in trust in major institutions. I do see, you could see in the future, like many, building up social capital and patronage networks rather than relying upon institutions, if there is like a major decline in trust in major institutions, and just how like white Americans are generally, they're generally fairly individualistic, or they think about like more kind of mass society as a whole. And then with like civic nationalism, like the kind of assimilationist model, like the Canadian model of multiculturalism and the salad bowl, and the critique from the right that that's bad for social cohesion. You see this with Europe, like the assimilationist model. Some European governments have, there's been like proposals to ban like the Muslim headscarves. But the thing about the kind of assimilationist model rather than multiculturalism is they're kind of assuming that their group is going to be dominant in the long run, and then being able to impose their values upon others. So the same, let's just say if the demographics fundamentally transform, then if that group is no longer the majority, they may have to sacrifice their culture for the values of the majority. So the kind of melting pot model that's been promoted generally, like mainstream American conservatives will say they support the melting pot, and I mean, that definitely has a flaw. So then there's you go into kind of the trends of just like neo-tribalism. A lot of these trends they could be cultural or sociological trends based on how people think or how people function rather than an official government system.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, the question is what does hold this diverse people together? You need to have a common, you need to have something common, something they can all agree upon, they can respect, you know. I mean, it would work, for example, in multi-ethnic or multinational empire, as long as the ruling monarchist house is acknowledged by all these people, it does work. But the moment this is in question and the legitimacy of monarchy or the emperor is in question, it does fall apart. Many people say that, for example, Yugoslavia did work as long as Maršal Tito was alive. He was a sort of integrating figure, which these different nations could agree upon. But as soon as he died, all the old national conflicts would come up again. They, you know, went back to decades, and then it all started off again. And as for the American model, well, the Americanism or the American idea is based on individualism. You acknowledge the individual, and when Americans will talk about pluralism, they think of a pluralism of individuals. This is what American liberalism is about. But now it turns out that individualism is not so much valued among certain ethnic group, or that there are other.
You're basically describing the double standard.
Yeah.
Like there's, like the term heritage Americans and that group. Mm. Is more individualistic. Yeah, they have an individualistic mindset, and then other groups come in who are more in-group preference, and they have an advantage. Mm. So, yeah, like how sustainable that kind of double standard is long-term. It's not so much, I think, the right complains about like a institution-imposed double standard, but I think it's just kind of the value of individualism and liberal idealism have just been a fundamental of America for a long time, because even like if you talk to a lot of Trump supporters when they talk about taking back America, even like the woke left will interpret that as a racist dog whistle. But even then, a lot of times they're thinking more in terms of Americanism.
Well, I think the point is, I think there's something true about this notion of some things being implicitly white. You see, so these values that Trumpers may share about, you know, they're old classical American values about the Constitution and about pursuit of happiness and individualism and all this, but these are not explicitly but implicitly white values. And even if colored people follow these ideals, and they will be happily embraced by most Trumpers. They are regarded by their in-group often as Uncle Toms and of people who are acting white or all this. So these values are connected to a certain demographic, to a certain way of thinking, to a certain group. It's also based in an Anglo-Protestant tradition. And here's one of the issues about ethno-pluralist criticism of universalism, that sometimes you may think that your values are universal, but you will find out at one point that maybe they are not. Maybe they are in fact tied to a certain demographic or a certain group or a certain culture, a certain way of thinking. And here comes in a sort of a paradox, which is also it's closely tied to the idea that all men are in fact equal, which is the basis of universalism. So you think everything that applies to one man or one group must apply to all. And of course, the whole idea of universalism, and universalism is something that is big in Western culture. It's one of the core things of Western culture. It wants things to be like this. Now it has this urge to say, we want to expand, we want to have it for everyone, and you may do it in a very good faith. You may really think that if you expand human rights on the whole planet, the world will become a better place, but it does not work in the end, because other cultures really are different. They really think different. They really have different concepts of how societies about the world, concepts about themselves, and so. And this is why the multiculturalist model had its biggest problems with Muslim immigration into Europe. So because Muslim values are on the whole more conflicting with Western values than any other, it's harder to integrate. I mean, it even, you know, is the source of animosity. You see the thing happening in France right now. I mean, they had again some Islamist attacks, and they have this problem for many, many years. They have a huge Muslim population, and now what to do about it? And Macron, he comes with the old French idea of they have to be converted to French values, like, you know, division of state and church. And
yeah, Macron is advocating like a civic nationalism, but based on liberalism, and yeah, kind of like assimilationism.
I mean, France, you know, it's interesting to see within the French New Right, there had been a conflict starting, I think, in the 80s or 1990s. There was this one Nouvelle Droite writer, Guillaume Fay. He died last year. And he split from Nouvelle Droite in 1986 or 87. And when he returned with this famous book, Archaeofuturism, he had a critique on ethnopluralism, the way it had developed within the new French, the French right. And he said, well, the concept makes perfect sense if you consider spatial separation. And if you use it as an argument in a French context, for example, you say, okay, the French, we withdraw from Algeria. There were actual settlements of French people in Algeria, the so-called Blackfeet, the Pieds Noirs, and they withdraw after the independence of Algeria. But then the next step is to say, okay, but we also refuse that we have now immigration from Algeria. We do not colonize you, but we also don't want you here. We have spatial separation. This is the way it would work. But now, this of course did not happen. There was a huge immigration from North African countries, former colonies, into France, and this created this whole Muslim Islam problem. And at one point, Alain de Benoist, he would adopt a view which was very similar to Charles Taylor, by the way, called communitarism, by communities, communitarism. I mean, he had to follow up on his old position that he would reject universalism, he would reject a centralist state, the French centralist state, and prefer, you know, the regions instead. And now you have all of a sudden this stubborn Muslim population, which is refusing to assimilate, which keeps on their values. And also Benoist thought, why should, if he doesn't want to have universalist values imposed on, for example, ethnic groups, regional ethnic groups within France, why should they be imposed on Muslims? So he would refuse this, and he would say, no, he's against, you know, they shall build mosques, it's okay. He's against all these laws, like banning burqas or so. I mean, of course, it has to be adjusted, so they would follow, Muslims would also follow the law, and there would not be too much conflict. But in fact, he would adopt the communitarian stance towards Islam or Muslims in France. I think he has changed ever since a bit this position, but he was criticized within French New Right circles that he has become an Islamophile. And Guillaume Fay, who was his old friend, and now they had separated, he would criticize him and say, well, the notion of ethnopluralism is absurd if you disregard the spatial separation. because now they are in our country. They do not belong here. The Algerians belong to Algeria. And now giving the Algerians special rights or autonomy or not even trying to make them assimilate is very dangerous, because it would mean they would demographically take over.
My general view is a lot of these trends of like globalization and the weakening of nation states, a lot of them could be inevitable. I think the trends that I see in the future are people acting more as like tribes or diasporas. So I think best case scenario would probably be like a rightist multiculturalism where all groups are allowed to have their own institutions and cultures, but there would have to be some kind of common agreement, and I'm sure the economic model would factor into that. So it's not perfect, but I think it's like the best case scenario.
You know, the thing is, I don't see this a chance for this common agreement. I mean, imagine, you know, you would have also Western nation states adopt an ethno-pluralist idea, but the thing is that those groups that immigrated, they are not ethno-pluralists. Usually people from Islamic countries are not ethno-pluralists at all. I mean, also Islam is a universalist religion, and I think Alain de Benoist, in a recent interview, he said as much, that Islam tends to have an expanding metapolitical force. You cannot say, I mean, ideally, the Charles Taylor politics of recognition thing would be that I recognize you're different, you recognize that I'm different, so I respect that you, I don't know, mutilate clitoris, and you respect that we wear miniskirts. I mean, you see I'm exaggerating here, but you can see that it actually doesn't really work, because although if you really believe in your cultural value system, you probably won't be able to tolerate so much things that really strongly go against your values. And there's always this, you know, this thriving, this will to power, this expansion. And here's one of my critiques of ethno-pluralism.
One thing I want to clarify about this is your book promoting the ideology?
Partly, yes. I mean, my main point is I just want to sort out what kind of ideas are there, to have an understanding, and then in the final chapter make an assessment what I think is worthy, what is useful, and what will not work. But I'm just proposing it. So you see, I leave it to the reader of my book to pick out what he thinks is working, or is makes sense, or is good. Yeah. So it's not a book promoting, but it's more written as a sort of understanding. I just want to understand first what is going on, and this is why the subtitle is also called Critique and Defense. So I'm both defending the concept, but I'm also criticizing it. But most of the book is right about the history of the concept, which I think helps to understand what it is about.
Then there is like the concept of freedom of association, and yeah, in the kind of American framework, the example of like Native American reservations, because of the history of oppression, like they're given some special rights to semi autonomy. So what do you think about like that model of expanding like semi autonomy to more like regional autonomy? And like, how familiar are you with that model of the Native American reservations, where they have control over who moves in there, and they have like their own school system, their own police?
I'm not sure if that works so well. I have read a lot of critique about it, that this become, you know, this is being abused, the system, for illegal activities, to have this casino thing going on. I'm not sure how much it works in order to protect the native identity. I mean, as an ethno-pluralist, this is the thing that would concern me the most, but I don't know how much American natives are concerned by that, or how much, you know, they really can keep up a Native American identity with modernization, how much this aligns, you see. So But I guess this is a minor thing or a minor problem because there are not so many of them still around. I don't see, I mean, on first glance, some reservations for Native Americans seem like a good thing, and they do not seem to impede national unity in a bigger sense. So now there might be some issues with illegal activities, or there might be some issues that they don't actually serve to protect Native American identity. I mean, one thing maybe I would like to address is that, you know, we live in a time where diversity is supposed to be the biggest value of all. So everything has to be diverse, and often it's not very clear what that concept means, but at the same time, concepts like ethnopluralism, which also aim for ethnic or racial diversity, they are regarded to be the enemy. You know, they are bad, they're evil, they're racist, and so. So there is a strange contradiction here. Often, you know, in the beginning I mentioned this literature on the far right, which also emphasizes that on the surface there may be similarities between multiculturalism and ethnopluralism, but of course these are totally different things. And so I see something strange going on. I see right-wing people today mostly have an agreement that they are not only they are not only striving for their own nation, but there's a common idea that we are fighting for the idea of nationhood in itself, or the idea of ethnic diversity in itself. And now there's a difference between multiculturalists and ethnopluralists, how this ethnic diversity can be maintained, what are the conditions of it, you see? And multicultural concepts are also not homogenic. There are different kinds of concepts, and sometimes they are pretty confused. Some people say you just mix people together. Some people say it's more like the Charles Taylor patchwork. And for some people, it's some sort of vague, fluid idea that in the future nobody will really have a fixed identity, everybody will be a sort of individual, and none of these things are really convincing. And here's the great one of another of the important differences between multiculturalists and ethnopluralists. That ethnopluralists say the differences can only be maintained if you segregate to some certain point. You don't have to completely isolate, yeah? But you have to have a border between you and the other group, and you cannot let anybody in. You cannot let anybody have a saying what your group is doing. And this is, of course, deemed as being, you know, racist and ignorant and all that. And actually, this sort of ethnopluralism that emphasizes that sometimes you need to be intolerant, or you need to be segregating in order to maintain your identity, was defended by the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. He was a French ethnologist and anthropologist, and he is in my book one of the most important thinkers of ethnopluralism. Even though he never used that word, he's not New Right or rightist at all, but in his he wrote two important essays for the UNESCO, one in 1951, one in 1972. One was called Race and Culture, and the other was called Race and History. And it's a bit complex to go more into detail into that, but the bottom line in his essay, Race and Culture, was where he said that, you know, the idea that everybody should be tolerant to everybody else, everybody should unify, everybody should acknowledge everybody else, first of all, it doesn't work out, and second, why should it work out? Because is it really a good idea if everybody embraces? Doesn't it mean that differences will fall away? Aren't differences also made of tensions and of antagonisms? And so what he was saying is this, that there are two ways that can go wrong. One way is you isolate yourself completely, then probably your culture, your tribe will also die. But the other way is that you open yourself up, you're completely tolerant, you give up your identity, then you will be overrun as well, or you will give up what is unique about yourself. You see, so he said you have to find a balance between segregating and between being open.
I think different concepts would make more sense in different geographic locations. So I think things are different in Europe, but like I'm from California, and I think for like California, for California in particular, like the kind of Canadian, the original Canadian model might be like the best case scenario, but it would be different for regions in Europe. You have to take into account each particular geographic location.
Yeah, certainly, because if you really take it seriously, that different people or cultures are different, then you will realize that you cannot have, you cannot make ethno-pluralism into a universalist idea. You're falling into a trap, because then you're also assuming in some strange way that maybe everybody is the same. So, here's one concept we should mention when we talk about ethno-pluralism. And this dates back to Herder, the German philosopher I mentioned. And this is the concept of the Volksgeist in German. Volksgeist, which means the spirit of the folk or the spirit of the people. You will find this word in German idealism, in Hegel or so, and it has a bit of a different meaning than in Herder. But the main idea is that every people or every folk or even every race or so has a certain spirit, has a certain soul that motivates it. And how can you see this soul? How can you describe it? And for Herder, who was a romantic philosopher, he could find it especially in folk poetry or in folk songs. He could find it in the expressions of the folk. They express something unique, some certain kind of spirit. And this is what he was looking for. And he had a vision of all these Volksgeist, of all these spirits, possibly one day living in a harmony, because each of them has a different color in the, the painting. If the world is a big painting that God has made, then every race, every folk, every people is a color, and everyone has a place in it. So this is a romantic, probably a bit too idyllic picture, but this idea of Volksgeist is very important, because it says there is a spirit in people and it might not match with others, so it's best when they have a place where they can live according to this spirit. Now there's a bit of a problem to that, because imagine that you might have a people or a certain nation, and the spirit of your nation is not in accordance with ethno-pluralism at all. You might be a Roman from antiquity, and as a Roman from antiquity, you would be convinced that it's your job to conquer the world, to extend the empire, to bring Roman civilization, Roman peace, much like Americans thought today or in the 20th century, that their civilization, their ideas, their values are good for everyone. So here's a contradiction that you might say all the Volksgeist, all the spirits of the folk might live according to their own genius or vocation, but what if this genius or vocation is against ethno-pluralist principles? You see what I mean?
I mean, as far as different regions of the world, you don't see it as compatible. You see it as more compatible with specific nations. Mm-hmm. Like specific examples, like just looking over the world.
But you see, there's a practical aspect to it, which also was in, you know, Henning Eichberg. For example, if you have a neoconservative view of the world, let's say an imperialist American Western chauvinist view of the world, you're, for example, convinced that you have to convert all the Islamic countries to a Western American way of life. And in order to do that, you have to do a lot of uprooting. I mean, you even might have to bomb them into democracy. And often these sort of rhetorics would be seen as a cover for more, will to power aims. So you would use a human rights or universalist rhetoric, but you had very mundane aims, you know. So what I'm saying is this, that universalism is something that is ingrained in our Western thinking, but at the same time, it's just not practical. You cannot make Africa to be like us. You cannot make Muslim countries to be like us. You know, it's absurd. It will not work. But the point is, it will not work in Africa, but it also will not work if you move Africans to Europe. You will not make, they will never become like us. They will never, you know, maybe some can, maybe can assimilate, but in the long run, it will not work out. And I think this is one of the important things to understand if you think in an ethno-pluralist way, that you have to take pluralism seriously. And this is what the left is not doing when they talk about diversity. If you look closer, they not really want to know about differences of between people. I called this the Smarties dogma. I don't know if you have this. A Smarties is a chocolate lens. Do you know it? And it's covered with a sugar coating. And it's very, very bright colors. So you have blue lenses, yellow lenses, red lenses. But the idea is that beyond the sugar coating, everybody is the same. So when leftists talk about diversity, they mean a very superficial kind of diversity. And if you look closer, they always think in racial terms.
Yeah. The idea of liberalism that all people are interchangeable cogs, but I actually, and that's capitalism's obviously part of that too, but I actually think that ironically the woke culture will backfire and lead to more like a neo-tribalism.
Yeah, it's because there are real differences there. And when right-wing people say, okay, you talk about diversity and about differences and how they shall be recognized and acknowledged, let's talk about real differences. Like, let's talk about sexual, religious, cultural, racial, all kinds of differences that there are. And then the left screams and says, oh, this is horrible, this is racism. So you see, this is very superficial. Diversity, if you type it in at Google image search, then you will find these images of these rainbow colored, you know, you have these people of all races and they're all smiling and they're all happy. And what is signaling diversity is actually their race or their visual race. You see, wow, okay, this man is Asian, this man is black, so it's diversity. But the message is that under this sugar coating, they are all the same. We are all the same. And this is what you would reject as a right winger. You would say, no, we are not all the same, but this is okay. This is good. You know, this is when, ethno-pluralism in its best sense comes in and it says, there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong that Africans are not like us or that Muslims are not like us. I'm not required to like it. You know, I still can have a judgment. I still can say, okay, I mean, they go their way, but still I think our way is better. You see, I don't think there's anything wrong in saying this, but it becomes a problem when you want to missionary others, when you say they should become like us, they should be more like this and this. It will not work, you know, it will just lead to terrible conflict and all that. But yeah, sure, I mean, at one point people want to be the same, but at the other, on the other side, they want to be different also. At one point, it's like a circle a bit. You see, there are both drives inside man. One is, I want to be equal, and the other is saying, I want to be different. I want to be recognized as being different. And this is why you cannot kill tribalism. It will always surface again and again.
What are your thoughts on Orania, the Afrikaner town in South Africa? Do you see that as a model of ethno-pluralism?
Well, they are in a besieged position, you know. I mean, of course, they try to maintain their identity. I mean, it's a better solution than apartheid. Apartheid could never have worked in the long run because you have a minority that depends on the labor of a majority of people. And you have all these sorts of segregations could never have worked. You know? So I guess the best solution would have been that all white people move into one part and all black people in the other part. But I guess there are issues with that. So I would not name anything in South Africa as a model for ethno-pluralism, but this is out of a crisis, you know. It was created as out of oppression, out of necessity, you see. And I don't think they have a bright future ahead. I mean, it looks really bad for South Africans, white South Africans, not just those that try to make this Rainier experiment, but all others.
You don't like see a scenario where the nation is partitioned into smaller ones?
It's a desperate measure. I mean, I can say Orania is a good example for ethno-pluralism. It's a desperate measure. I mean, good luck with it. But I think in the long run, they are doomed. Probably they should resettle somewhere else. I don't know. I mean, I hope they will not be doomed. I hope they will survive. I hope there will be a way that they can survive. But it's just made out of necessity. And I mean, it's an example that especially if you are a besieged minority, you have to be intolerant, sort of. You see, you have no other way. Otherwise, you will not survive. I mean, Levi Strauss made this point, for example, about the natives of the Amazon. These were the ones he studied. What his most famous book was called *Triste Tropique*, the sad tropics, sad rainforests. And he was writing about how hard it was for natives in the Amazons to keep their way of living. You know, they were modernized, they were exterminated. Their space they inhabited, you know, was destroyed, the rainforests and all this. And they had to become intolerant, you know, towards others, towards other groups in order to maintain their identity. But there's always one point when you reach the end of the line. I mean, for example, there are a few peoples on this planet that are not contacted. There are supposedly some in the rainforest still, but for example, there's this tiny tribe in the Indian Ocean. If you remember this story, a few years ago, an American missionary tried to go there.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. He came there with a football, and of course they just, you know, killed him and ate him up. I don't know. No, they did not eat him up, but he was just killed, and authorities of India, they did not intervene or do anything. I mean, I read nobody's even sure how many are on this island. It's probably, some say it's just 20 people, some say it's more than 100. But you see, these are probably the last not contacted tribe. They had no direct contact with civilization except killing everybody who tries to approach them. But you can see they are doomed. If they are just 20 people, I mean, how shall they procreate? It will just be, you know, incestuous degeneration, and one day they will disappear, and probably nobody will really miss them. Yeah, I mean, this is also one aspect of ethno-pluralism. I call it the romantic ethno-pluralism, which is the dirge or the mourning about the disappearance of native tribes. I give you one example. I mean, are you familiar with that book, Camp of the Saints, by Charles Bai?
Yeah, you know what? I have a copy of it, but I haven't. Yeah. I just started reading it.
Okay, it's about this invasion of third world people to Europe, and Europe is in a sort of religious frenzy, welcoming everybody, and of course this turns out very bad, and they get overrun by the masses from the third world. And now the interesting thing about Charles Bai is that he used to be a traveler in the 1940s and 50s as a young man, and he had a special love for Patagonia in the, you know, South America. Really deep down South America. And he says that in his youth he would witness the last remnants of a tribe which were sea nomads. They were in a native tribe, and they lived on the sea. They were nomads. And they lived a very harsh and brutal life. And they gradually became extinct the moment when they got into contact with people from the West, from Europe. And he wrote a novel about them, and it's a sort of reverse Camp of the Saints, which is, from the point of view of the natives, and the invasion of Europeans becomes a disaster for them. In the long run, they are doomed to disappear, to die. And Charaspal said he saw in a snowstorm on the sea, he saw far away one of their boats. It was empty. And he really got shiver and terrified. And years later, he thought, what if this could happen to us? You know, what if we, the Western or white people, would disappear one day? And he would pursue his interest in these lost tribes. And one of his greatest books, which is not translated into English, but into German, was called The Aches from the Steppe. Is this word the steppe or the grasslands, the aches from the grasslands? And it's about his searches for lost tribes all over the world, and his experience he had, especially in the Caribbean Sea. He knew it very well, but he also has a fascinating story about Germans who were with Napoleon when Napoleon invaded Russia, and German soldiers stayed there. And they married women who were there who had no man, and they lived in a village ever since and maintained the German language. And then in 1941, when German troops again invaded, well, this time German troops back then, French troops, but there were German soldiers also there, Prussian soldiers. So in 1941, German troops invade Russia, and these German soldiers come to this village, and they see the descendants of the Germans who were with Napoleon, and they speak German and they recognize each other and refuse to stay with them. I don't know if he had invented that story. It seems like he has invented this one, but he has a lot of stories about these disappearing small ethnic groups on this planet. And this book is also a lament. It says, well, this is the course of the modern world. Diversity actually disappears. The more we talk about diversity nowadays, the less we have. Because that people become more and more the same, consuming the same things is a fact. You know? I mean, I don't think they will ever become all the same. You know,
that's the objective of ethnopluralism, is to preserve that. But I just think tribalism is such a powerful instinct. Yeah, I see it as inevitable. And I think the idea, the idea that the left, they want to kind of abolish tribes, but I just see maybe new tribes could form out of changes, like new identities. So those are the kind of the trend long term. Before I wrap up the show, Martin, do you want to comment on the current events, briefly on the current events in Austria, and then also if you want to plug your book, the publisher, and then where people can find it, and if you're planning to release an English edition?
Yeah, I'm not so sure if it would be interesting for English audience. I haven't thought about it, actually. It says pretty well here. The first edition is almost gone. And so, I don't know. It's not up to me to decide. Maybe somebody would be interested. And as for your first question, well, I mean, this is the first major Islamist attack we had in Austria. I mean, there was one in the 1980s, but this was Palestinians attacking a synagogue. And now we have something more like in France. And as it turns out, it is really, let's say, an ethnic problem. We had, unfortunately, Muslim immigration. It started in the 1960s with the Turks. We had lots of Muslims coming from Bosnia in the 1990s, and also Chechenians. And now we have this guy who basically ran amok in the Vienna inner city. It turns out that there's a network behind him. There are a lot of sympathizers. Austrian police made some raids in Islamist organizations and in mosques. And there's a real swamp there, you know, and it was created by a false immigration politics. And now it seems like in Austria we are starting to face the same problems as in France. Of course, they are far more progressed, it's much worse there, but I see these problems coming up here, and of course nobody has a solution. They just say the same lines as they say in France or anywhere else that did not work there, but at least they are doing something and now doing raids in mosques and Islamist organizations. I don't know how this will work out, but it came as a big shock to me. I mean, I live in Vienna and I think this is a total horrible thing, and it really depressed me.
It is a really really troubling situation. It was great speaking with you, and for people in the audience at least who are fluent in German, check out his book Ethnopluralismus and Martin Lichtschmerz. It was great speaking with you, and thanks for being on.
Thank you for inviting me.